Hamilton County's prosecutor has made a big determination about the police officer who fatally shot a Cincinnati teenager last month, and federal authorities deport another teen who just graduated from a local high school. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our news review, we'll discuss details of these cases and how the families of these young men are responding, along with other ICE detentions. We'll also talk about the latest on the Hyde Park Square redevelopment project and what P.G. Sittenfeld is telling friends and family about his presidential pardon. We have a lot of ground to cover today. Here to get us started are Cincinnati Inquirer reporters, Patricia Gallagher Newberry, Victoria Morwood, and Cameron Knight. Welcome back, Patty, Victoria, and Cameron. It's great to have an Inquirer trifecta here at the top of the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Victoria, let's talk about this 19-year-old who was deported first. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so Emerson Colindres, he recently graduated from Dater High School. He's a big soccer player. His mom, Ada, moved to the U.S. back in 2014 when he was just 8 years old, also moved with his sister, who was young at the time. She said that they were fleeing persecution from gangs in their native country of Honduras. And so they've been living here in the Cheviot area since then.
And Victoria, has ICE released any statement about why he was arrested?
Not yet. We've reached out to ICE several times. Basically, the situation was that when his mom, Ada, first moved here, she followed the legal process. She applied for asylum in 2014, but her claim was denied, which happens. So what you do next is you appeal, and she appealed to several different courts. And that's a very lengthy process that can take several years, which it did. And then finally, in August of 2023, the family of three received an order of final removal, which basically meant that to ICE, they were considered deportable at that time. So, you know, ICE could have asked them to leave the country since that period in time, but we don't know why Emerson was detained and held at the Butler County Jail for a few weeks while his mom and sister were not. We still don't have the answer to that question.
Patty, you've reported on some other recent ICE arrests. Tell us what happened at this Kroger in Price Hill.
So on May 31st, federal agents arrived at a Kroger parking lot in East Price Hill on Warsaw Avenue. They arrested four individuals on that day. Among them was Alonzo Tomas Mendez. Mr. Mendez is 34. He hails from Guatemala. We did not know his name until this past week when his advocates arranged for a press conference to tell his story. So what we've learned about him since then is that he came to the United States about 3.5 years ago, a little unclear when he landed in Cincinnati. He has a partner who is the mother of his two children. His daughters are 7 and 4. And on the day in question, he was at the Kroger to pick up some birthday party supplies for one of the family members. Three agents followed him into the store, and then he was arrested when he came back out into the parking lot. The agents also apparently were attempting to enter the car where the partner and the daughters were, but not successful. Don't know why they were not successful. But that's what we know about his case so far. He has, since May 31st, been held at the Butler County Jail, along with more than 400 other detainees that Butler County is holding for the federal government. He has yet to have a hearing. One was supposed to happen on Wednesday of this week. It did not happen. That was the second one that was scheduled and didn't happen. And his supporters tell me one is scheduled for next week, but we don't know the day yet.
Victoria, you reported that Emerson Colindres, his lawyer says that before he was deported, he was moved without notifying his family. Can you talk with us about that? What happened there?
Yes. So on Tuesday, he was moved from the Butler County Jail to, it ended up being an ICE processing facility in Louisiana. But the night before that, he was told he was going to be moved early the next morning. And so he told his mom that, he told his lawyer, but they didn't know why. No, nothing was, he didn't know, am I being deported? Am I being transferred? And his lawyer had just recently filed a motion in his case. So, you know, they were concerned that this motion was not going to have time to get any kind of response if he was being moved or even possibly deported, you know, just hours, half a day later. So he was moved to a facility in Louisiana. And then the morning after that, he was deported to Honduras. And he was informed the night before that he was being deported. So he was able to tell his mom that. So she did know finally that he was going to be flown to Honduras. But, you know, in the days before that, it was a lot of them calling ICE, trying to get answers. And they were really in the dark about what was happening to their client and their son.
What do we know about where he's being held in Honduras, Victoria?
So the plane went to San Pedro Sula, which is, and it has an airport there, which seems to be where deportees from the U.S. are flown to. And thankfully for Emerson, he does have relatives in Honduras. His mom told me they live about 4 hours away from that airport. So she was, you know, when she knew he was being deported, she was scrambling to find somebody who could pick him up from the airport. So that's where he is now. His relatives were able to pick him up. So he's with them. And then this morning, Fox 19 reported that his mom and sister, who were also, they were given 30 days to leave the country. They are planning to leave the U.S. and go back to Honduras on Monday. So I will get back in touch with them, but I would assume that they're going to, you know, meet up with Emerson and their relatives that they do have over there.
Okay. So he is not being held. He's with relatives now in Honduras, as far as you know.
Right. And it is the process, it seems, can differ. You know, if you have someone who can pick you up, or if you're going to need more assistance when you arrive in Honduras, it seems to kind of vary on the person and your situation. But for Emerson, since he did have relatives, yeah, they were able to pick him up. So he was not held by authorities too much, you know, longer.
Hmm. Patty, Victoria walked us through the immigration process and for Emerson's family. What have federal officials said about why Mr. Mendez is being detained, this gentleman who was picked up at this Kroger in, I think you said, East Price Hill, and why he's being held? Do you have much information on that?
Not too much, Lucy. When the arrests were made, May 31st, ICE did provide a statement to the Inquirer that said he was detained because he is here illegally. His advocates have confirmed that he does not have legal status in the United States. ICE at that time also said that two of the four individuals had criminal charges against them, one related to a DUI, one related to public intoxication. We found no record in Hamilton County for Mr. Mendez in the court system here, so we do not believe that he has criminal charges against him or has had. And his supporters confirm that he does not have any criminal charges. You know, he was working and living his life and supporting his family. That's all we know.
And does he have a lawyer?
He did not earlier in the week, but by Wednesday when they had the press conference, I was told he has an attorney, but I did not obtain the name of the attorney. So I have not been able to get any more additional information on that, nor have we been able to talk to his family, the partner or the children, of course, who are said to be afraid to, show their faces or speak to the media.
And you said there's a hearing that is supposed to be scheduled for next week, although there was a hearing earlier this week that got canceled or postponed.
Correct. And these would be virtual hearings because the court for immigration is up in Cleveland. And that's the only way the folks down here who are being detained in Butler County can interact with the justice system.
Well, we will be talking more about these cases on our show Tuesday. Again, today is our Cincinnati Edition Weekly News Review. I'm going to turn now to Cameron Knight. Cameron, a local gym owner was stabbed to death in Over the Rhine earlier this month. Briefly tell us the background on that case.
So in that case, there was a stabbing in the afternoon evening hours, I believe. It was overnight, and there was a it was a the police have said there is was a break-in sort of situation. There was an unknown person in someone's home. There was a confrontation between this business owner and also the suspect, and it became a fight. The business owner was stabbed fatally, and since then, his wife has taken up a call to kind of pressure the city to do more about violent crime, particularly in Over the Rhine. And her kind of pleas have gotten some response from the city government, from the state. The issue at hand with the suspect was that he was out on probation, what they call supervised release, but what I think most people would call probation. He had served a sentence for an earlier crime, and he had finished that sentence and was released. And he was supposed to have an ankle monitor on. He had cut that off. Police said that he had committed another burglary, and they just had not caught him yet. They hadn't found him. And then he turns up as a suspect in this homicide.
And I know, the police have said we weren't notified about the ankle monitor being cut off, that the state officials are now saying they're going to change their process. So,
right. So that's one of the results that happened from Sarah Herringer. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing her last name. She said that there needs to be more communication. The police chief and the mayor both said the state didn't inform them that this guy was at large, is what they refer to it as. And the Ohio Department of Rehabilitations and Corrections maintains that they did inform them by filing a warrant the day that it happened, or within a day or so of the ankle monitor being cut off. They maintain that that was informing them. They filed a warrant for his arrest, all of that. But the Department of Rehabilitations and Corrections said they are going to amend their policy to make a more direct contact as soon as something like this happens, as opposed to just filing a warrant, which, law enforcement can see and they can check. They're going to make more direct contact with law enforcement to get that done. The police chief and the mayor have all been kind of trying their best to make moves to address this issue.
Yeah. And I know there were, he was indicted. The man accused of killing Patrick Herringer was indicted this week. You can find more information about those charges on Cincinnati.com. Let's also talk about what Hamilton County's prosecutor decided this week about this fatal shooting of an 18-year-old by a Cincinnati police officer. Tell us briefly why police were there, who this young man is, and how he got shot.
Yeah, so this was on May 1st, I believe. It was the person's name is Ryan Hinton. He's 18 years old. He was in a car with three other individuals. The car had been reported stolen. The owner of the car was able to track where it was by GPS. I guess they had GPS monitoring in the car. They told police where it was. Police came in to check on the location of the car. We were told they sent in ununiformed, undercover, plain clothes officers to kind of look at the car first. They saw that there were people in the car. They kind of backed off and sent in uniformed officers. The uniformed officers came in. The people in the car fled. And during that, there's a lot of competing kind of narratives about exactly how things went down. But basically, the police started to pursue them. And Ryan Hinton, as he was running, police said he had a gun and pointed at an officer, and he was shot by a Cincinnati police officer. And go ahead.
Yeah, and the Hamilton County prosecutor made an announcement this week about kind of what she determined. Tell us what she determined about that.
Correct. So Connie Pillich, the Hamilton County prosecutor, decided that she was not going to file any charges against the officer. She kind of, cleared of any wrongdoing. And she, this kind of came as in opposition to what the family was hoping for. The family of Ryan Hinton has already been outspoken about what's gone on. They've been calling for transparency, calling for an independent investigation. And in cases like this, in neighboring counties even, the prosecutor can choose to take cases to a grand jury. And in this case, Connie Pillich decided to not take the case to a grand jury to decide whether there should be criminal charges pressed or not. The family held a press conference right after the announcement, and they criticized Pillich for not taking it to a grand jury. They also criticized the process of not having an independent body come in to investigate it ahead of this decision to not press charges.
And as I understand it, the prosecutor said she thought the shooting was justified, that the officer was justified in shooting because he thought that Ryan Hinn was pointing a gun at him.
Correct. And she said that the officer said in interviews that he felt that he had to fire before he was fired upon, mm-hmm. essentially.
You mentioned that Ryan Hinton's family has been disappointed by this, about the process, about the outcome. Is there still a city investigation underway into this shooting?
There are still multiple investigations underway in this story, in this situation. There's the lawyers for the family are still investigating. They have promised that they are filing a civil lawsuit. The charges that were related to Connie Pillich's realm would have been criminal charges, but civil litigation could still occur. So they're still investigating. The Citizens Complaint Authority, which was set up in the wake of the collaborative and monitors police activity and misconduct, they're still investigating. That investigation is still ongoing. And there's still an administrative investigation happening in the Cincinnati Police Department, which would determine whether there are violations of policy that occurred during the shooting, which would be separate from like criminal charges. It would be like you didn't turn your body camera on, or you didn't, you know, approach the situation in the correct way, or more policy and procedural type things.
So a lot still left to learn about all this. Cameron, we've talked repeatedly on this program about gun violence, and homicides. You recently reported on a different aspect of gun violence, and that's suicides where firearms are used. How common are suicides involving guns as compared with homicides that involved guns?
Right. So yeah, I've spent 10 years reporting on gun violence in Cincinnati, which most people I think of as homicide shootings, drive-bys, those sorts of instances. And what I wanted to take a look at was, what if we threw suicides into that gun violence basket? What would that look like? And I learned through looking at state health data and kind of mapping it across the state that it's there's more gun suicides than gun homicides in Ohio, significantly more. 3 out of 5 gun deaths are suicides, not homicides. And the other surprising thing about it to me was that if you map the gun death rate around Ohio, if you look at gun homicides, it's the places that you would think. It's the urban environments. It's Hamilton County. It's Dayton. It's Franklin County and Columbus. It's Cleveland. Those are the places where there's a high concentration of gun homicides. But when you map that, use those same numbers for gun suicides and map them across the state, the entire state lights up. And they are, they're happening everywhere all the time. And they're a problem in places where you don't have any problems with what we would necessarily call traditional gun violence.
And I think it's important to say right now that if anyone listening is in crisis, or if you have a loved one in crisis, the 988 Suicide and Crisis Line is available 24 hours a day. Just call or text 988. You mentioned this distinction between gun deaths in more urban counties compared with more rural counties. You said that gun deaths by suicide are all over the place, but it sounds like they can be fairly concentrated in more rural counties, is that right?
Yeah, we're not talking about raw numbers here. We're talking about rates, so gun deaths per 1,000 people. And when you look at those rates, the worst counties in the state for gun suicides are rural counties. And Whitney Austin, who you all might remember from the shooting that occurred on the Fifth Third Center, She started a nonprofit foundation to kind of help go after all forms of gun deaths. And she has launched programs to start looking at that in rural counties. She has pilot programs in Kentucky and Ohio, where she's sending people from her group, Whitney Strong, into these areas to try to address this issue and teach people how to reach out and how to talk to people who are struggling, and also, you know, gun safety in these areas is when you grow up around guns, it's a little bit different. So they kind of approach things in a different way. So they are trying to do some prevention in this area.
So you mentioned what Whitney Austin is doing through her Whitney Strong group. What do experts say can be done to reduce these numbers? I mean, there are a lot of guns in Ohio.
Sure. And I think the overall thing is trying to address mental health. And the other thing, I spoke to a mother who lost her son to a gun suicide in a few years back. And her message to parents when they have kids that are dealing with this is to get the guns out of the house. It's an access. For her, it was an access issue. So to make sure that in that brief moment where someone is considering whether or not to harm themselves, to have that temptation of using a firearm to be removed from the situation has really good results, according to the experts and this mother, Tiffany Kimball, who has started her own foundation for her son, Ben Kimball, who took his own life.
Well, I think your story pointed out that people who try to kill themselves using other means have a much lower rate of fatality than people who try to kill themselves using guns. So that access
right.
has to be very important.
Right. It's a matter of how much harm can be done in a small amount of time, and guns are pretty effective at that.
Yeah. Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer reporters Patricia Gallagher Newberry, Victoria Morwood, and Cameron Knight. Thank you all so much for your time today.
You bet.
Thanks.
Up next, what P.G. Sittenfeld is telling friends and family about his presidential pardon. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The team behind a redevelopment of Hyde Park Square is moving forward with its plans. Or is it? Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the latest with that and to shed new light on President Trump's pardon of a former Cincinnati City Council member is Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Well, thanks for being here. We talked on the show a couple weeks ago about President Trump's pardon of P.G. Sittenfeld. You reported that this news surprised him as much as it did the rest of us?
That is what he said in a letter to family and friends that we obtained. He's written a number of these letters over the years. It's actually been about a year since he wrote one that we were able to get our hands on. But yes, he said that he was surprised. He was as surprised as the rest of us were to see that pardon, which, you know, happened in the very early morning or late evening, I guess, at the end of May.
Huh. And in that letter, how did he describe his reaction to the news?
Well, he said, I'll just quote him for a couple of these things. He said, "I did not know the pardon was coming. And when I first heard the news, I was stunned, as I suspect you were. Our family is overjoyed, deeply relieved, and profoundly grateful that my freedom is secure and that we are and will remain together." I'm sure listeners probably remember that he had appealed his conviction to the Sixth Circuit, which is based here in Cincinnati. And on a 2-1 decision, they decided that they upheld his conviction and said it was solid. There was a solid legal basis for the jury convicting him of those corruption charges. However, they also said that this area of the law was perhaps ripe for a Supreme Court review. And so he had been, the lawyers who were representing him, Jones Day, which is a very high powered legal team out in Washington, D.C., with a bunch of lawyers that have ties to the Trump administration. They were preparing his bid to the Supreme Court to get them to actually take the case. They were not yet preparing the brief arguing for his appeal being overturned, but they were just trying to get the court to take the case.
remind us just briefly of the details of his case.
Yeah, he was convicted in 2022. He had one count of bribery and one count of an attempted extortion. That was in connection to accepting $20,000 in campaign contributions from undercover FBI agents posing as developers, and Chinedu Madukwe, who is a developer. And this was kind of surrounding a project that was planned for the former Convention Place Mall, which is on Elm Street, or was on Elm Street downtown. It's a vacant lot right now. It's been demolished.
In this letter that P.G. Sittenfeld wrote to friends and family, did he explain how this pardon came to be? I mean, he said he was surprised by it. Did he explain how it happened?
Rather obliquely. Here's what he said about it. I mentioned Jones Day, which, of course, has these ties to the Trump administration. This is what he wrote about it. The brilliant and incredible legal team at Jones Day had a completed draft of our petition seeking Supreme Court review ready to submit. When you're seeking to keep your family intact, you understandably think through every possibility for doing so, but the prospect of a pardon always seems very remote. As I now understand it, my case came on the radar of the White House counsel's office, and it was advanced for a pardon. So he mentions in the same kind of paragraph, Jones Day and what they were doing. And then he says, well, my case came on the radar of the White House counsel's office. So he's not directly saying that the Jones Day folks put in a good word with him or with the Trump folks or whatever. He's not directly making that connection. But the fact that they're mentioned in the same kind of paragraph was interesting to me. And it's also important to kind of lay out the ties, right? So he had two lawyers on his appeal, James Burnham and Yakov Roth. Those were the Jones Day attorneys. And so both of them made oral arguments for him during the post-conviction part of the case. Burnham had clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. And he was just recently, until recently, general counsel for DOGE, the Elon Musk government efficiency department. And then Burnham also served in the White House counsel's office as well as the Justice Department during President Trump's first term. And then Roth, he currently is principal deputy assistant attorney for the Attorney General for the Justice Department Civil Division. And he also clerked for the late Justice Scalia. So these are very connected conservative lawyers that were working on his case.
Wow. Do you have thoughts on this? Why do you think President Trump pardoned P.G. Sittenfeld? I mean, the president has pardoned other people convicted on corruption charges and for similar white collar crimes. Is there anything, you know, we should make of this or we can take away from that?
That is like the billion-dollar question, and I don't think anybody really knows. We do know that P.G. Sittenfeld has made he's made the argument that this was an overreach by the Justice Department in charging him, that his campaign contributions that he accepted were perfectly legal and from people that he believed agreed with him politically, and that this was a criminalization of run-of-the-mill political activity. And, you know, we kind of know that President Trump also believes that he was persecuted unjustly in various cases against him. We can go through a chapter and verse, I'm sure. There are quite a bit, of course. So maybe the Trump folks and the president and his legal team found something that they, you know, thought was in common with themselves. That's speculation, pure speculation. So. But that's, you know, that's kind of some of the chatter that's out there.
Now, you referenced this before. There was talk of taking this case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that still possible?
P.G. Sittenfeld in his letter seems to believe that it is. He doesn't really go into the legal mechanics of how that is possible, given that he has received a pardon. But he indicates that the legal team believes there are enough issues at stake here that they can make at least an appeal to the Supreme Court to take the case. You know, whether they're able to do that, of course, is really uncertain. As we all know, the Supreme Court takes very few cases each term. And I don't know if they'll consider it a good use of their time to take something that's somebody's already been pardoned for.
Why does P.G. Sittenfeld say he wants to keep fighting this in court? Why take it or keep pushing to take it to the Supreme Court?
Well, he talks about that, and let me quote him directly again. He said, simply put, I don't want what happened to me to ever happen to other people who go into public service for good reasons. If the misguided charging theory of this prosecution, that lawful campaign donations between donors and candidates who share the same policy objectives can be construed as bribery, isn't halted, how many qualified people will be too afraid to ever run for office? Hmm.
Does he say anything in that letter about his plans for the future or whether he'll be running for public office again?
He does address that briefly. He says that he was proud of his time in office, but he doesn't have any desire to do it again or to run again. He's kind of tried to embark, it looks, as a career on as a writer. He had a piece published in Slate reflecting on his relationship with his late father just this past week. And otherwise, he says he plans to spend time with his wife and two sons. And they got a third kid on the way, he says.
There was a ruling this week that appears to have put the brakes on this Hyde Park Square redevelopment project. We've talked about this project a number of times on the show. Remind us what this project would do and why it's been so controversial in Hyde Park.
Yeah, what they're planning to do is build a $150 million mixed-use project on Hyde Park Square, mostly on a vacant parking lot, but they are going to demolish a couple of one-story buildings. They'll basically bring 125 new apartments. They will refurbish the Elace building, which is already there. It's up the corner there at Edwards Road. And they'll put in 350 underground parking spaces and also bring back some of the retail space that they will demolish as they develop this project. So it's a big mixed-use project with a lot of different purposes.
And there's been quite a bit of vocal opposition to the project too.
True. Yes, there are the folks in Hyde Park, particularly, although they would say that citywide there is skepticism and opposition to it. But their belief is that it is too tall. It's approved by the city at 85 feet. They believe it should be no higher than 50 feet. They also have concerns about traffic and pedestrian safety issues, and believes those exist now and would be exacerbated by the development.
So tell us what this court ruling was all about this week.
So there is a property owner who owns a one-story building at 2717 Erie, and it's between the Elace building and one of the properties that the developers, PLK Communities, Lauren Group, and North Point Group plan to demolish. So he has this man who owns the building. His name is Lee Robinson. He owns this one single building, and it has about six parking spaces in the back. And so he did not sell his property as a part of the development, so it would remain. But his argument is that he is entitled to have access to his parking spaces, and that the development as planned would basically prohibit that it would basically block in his parking spaces and not give him access to it. So he went to court and has been in court since late last year. And this week, Judge Patrick Dinkelacker granted a temporary injunction to Mr. Robinson. And basically it says, you got to give him access to those parking spaces. So at this point, I'm not sure that it necessarily stops the development in its tracks, but they definitely have to pursue this in court. A temporary injunction means for now you cannot block off these parking spaces as you make the development. So it's I think it remains to be seen what happens next, but it's certainly another speed bump in this large saga that has been ongoing.
Yeah. Well, and you had just reported this week that the Hyde Park Square development team was moving forward. What did they announce earlier this week?
Yeah, what they're planning to do is hire a number of design firms to kind of lead the effort. The main one is MSA Design, which I think people know. Michael Schuster is the head of that. And they've also hired a couple of others, the drawing department and Bayer Becker, which will do some engineering work. And so those are the teams that will start to really map out what this project will look like. It was an interesting you know, decision to announce this week, given that there is all of this uncertainty. Not only this was announced even before the court ruling came, but also given that we potentially will have an election over this project in November, given that citizens have gathered enough signatures to put it on the ballot.
Right. And I mean, the last time we talked about this on the program, you were with us and we talked about how one option would be for the development team to withdraw its request for a zoning change for this to kind of eliminate the concerns that residents had. I guess this shows they're not planning to withdraw that request.
It is all on the table, they said, still. That all of that is a possibility still, but they also want to get the project moving and continue, you know, discussions with the community. You know, so they've moved in the direction of hiring these folks. My understanding, I think, is that they would be designing the project, even if they come to some other understanding or agreement as to what it, you know, whether it changes or what it would look like. They're not precluding any of the options that are out there, whether it's going to the ballot or revising the, you know, revising the plan or coming up with a new plan.
You referenced this earlier, but these opponents of this project gathered, you know, 18,000 signatures, a good chunk of those valid, and this could be on the ballot still in November.
Very much so, yeah. City Council will have to vote in August whether they could either repeal the planned development that they approved for this site, which allows them to build the hotel and at the height that they want to build, or they could say, nope, we'll go to the ballot. And so they're kind of two choices and then some sub choices among them as well, where the developer could back out and say, well, we're going to do something different.
And you said the developer said, hey, everything's still on the table, but we want to keep moving forward. Do you think, is this about showing the community more about what this project would look like? I mean, do the developers think that maybe that could win over some people who are opposed to the project right now?
Potentially, but my impression is not that they're going to just design the thing and then show them something before August. I don't think that's the plan. I think it's more that they want to keep it going and have a process underway in order to, you know, start the design process. What they don't want to do is sit on their hands for the next, you know, 4 or 5 months until the election.
Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thank you so much for your time today, Chris.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, our news review continues. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Friends are mourning a woman found shot and killed earlier this month in Evanston. Joining me now to talk about her death and the larger trend it's part of is Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Elizabeth Kim. Thanks so much for being here, Betsy.
Thanks for having me.
Betsy, you reported on this woman who was found earlier this month in Evanston. Tell us about her.
Yeah, Laura Schuler was 47 years old, and friends I talked to describe her as a real mainstay of the Cincinnati LGBTQ community. I talked to one of her close friends who'd known her for nearly 30 years. He described her as the Beyonce of our city. He said that she loved fashion and was very loyal to her friends, especially when they were having a hard time.
And sadly, her death is part of a larger trend?
That's right. So the Human Rights Campaign is an advocacy group that tracks the violent deaths of trans and gender nonconforming individuals. It ranges between a dozen and 59 deaths, or at least it has in the past 10 years or so. The trend is that Black trans women take the brunt of the violence. So when victims could be identified, 62% of known victims between 2013 and 2023 were Black trans women, as Laura was.
Hmm. And you mentioned those figures. Are those figures that you mentioned, is that annual? I mean, what do we know about how many trans and gender nonconforming people have been killed in the U.S. over a longer time frame? What does the data show there?
Yeah, so at least a dozen people have been killed every year. The Human Rights Campaign said that they assume that this is an undercount. State and local authorities are not federally required to report this information to the FBI. The FBI does track these deaths that could be considered hate crimes against trans people every year. But because they're getting their information from state and local authorities who aren't required to report every time this happens, this is definitely an area where the data quality remains lacking. And a lot of people consider these numbers to be an undercount.
Are Cincinnati police investigating this as a hate crime? Do you know?
So I've talked with them. They have not made any arrests in connection with the homicide and have said that the investigation is too early to determine motive. However, it is important that people know that hate crime legislation in Ohio is limited to what's called ethnic intimidation. So that's when someone is violently targeted because of their race, skin color, religion, or national origin. So trans people actually are not covered by Ohio's hate crime legislation. This means that if you are trans in the state of Ohio and you are killed because you are trans, your death will not be prosecuted as a hate crime by local authorities. Ohio is a bit different from around more than 20 other states, which do explicitly identify sexual orientation and gender identity as protected classes in their hate crime laws. But Ohio does not. This is different federally. So the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act, when it was enacted in 2009, it expanded the federal hate crime definition to include crimes motivated by gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, as well as disability. So federal authorities can prosecute someone who has committed violence against a trans person on the basis that they were trans. And that is something that did happen in October of last year. A man in South Carolina was sentenced to life in prison for murdering a Black transgender woman. So it is quite rare that federal authorities prosecute someone for committing an anti-trans hate crime, but it happens on occasion.
You mentioned a little bit earlier how friends described Laura Shuler. Can you tell us any more about that and just what kind of friend she was to others? It sounds like she was very caring.
Yeah, I was really touched by friends' accounts of her. I talked to Tyson Carter, who is the friend I mentioned before, knew Laura for nearly 30 years, and he said that she was a bigger sister, like a big sister to him. He said that when he was having a really hard time with her mental health, she called him every day, was texting him, bothering him to make sure that he was okay. Something else that he said was something along the lines of, "You rolled out the carpet for Miss Laura when you saw her." So that's the kind of person that she was to the community.
You know, we've been talking about this larger issue of trans people being victims of violence like this. When you talk to people, what did you hear about the reasons behind these deaths?
Ooh, yeah, that's a great question. The Human Rights Campaign has said that frequently these are victims who were killed by partners, family members, and acquaintances. So domestic violence is absolutely an issue that hurts trans people. In the data that was collected that I reported on, you can see that deaths peaked in 2021, which is in line with what we've seen from data right around the pandemic. When people were isolating and staying inside, they were definitely more vulnerable to domestic violence at the hands of their partners or family members. And so the trans community definitely is not immune to that and certainly is vulnerable to it.
You also mentioned that trans people, in your story, you mentioned that trans people can have problems with just jobs and economic struggles too. Does that sometimes play into this?
Yeah, it's something that I heard from an advocate earlier, was that housing and employment, that there are a lot of barriers for trans people to have a home that is safe, that they can sleep in, have, land a job. And so certainly those are factors that make them more vulnerable, possibly more dependent on people for things like housing. which I can't imagine is great for their safety or financial independence as well.
Sure. What was there a message that advocates had for others that you heard from them just about, keeping trans neighbors and friends and loved ones safe?
Wow. What a great question. Say her name is something that I heard quite a bit. We know that these deaths are underreported, and friends and advocates definitely felt it was important for people to know who she was and how much she meant to Cincinnati.
Do they feel like these are particularly difficult times for trans people and the LGBTQ plus community?
For sure. There's been an onslaught of anti-trans legislation in so many different states in these recent years. And that certainly doesn't make things easier for trans people. On the safety note, I'm really not sure. It seems to be a pretty dire time. It's Pride Month, and I know that this is not some news that you want to get ever, but I think during Pride Month, it's an especially tragic story.
Yeah. Well, and I think what you said about just say her name is really important. What you heard from people about just the kind of person she is and making sure that people know what kind of friend and neighbor was lost in this crime. I think that's really important, what you brought up there.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's important to note that we don't necessarily know if the Cincinnati area is worse than other cities in Ohio or states when it comes to anti-trans violence. What we can say is that Laura's death is not the first. In 2020, Rhea Milton, a 25-year-old Black trans woman, was killed in Liberty Township. And in the following year, Diamond Kyrie Sanders, who was 23, was also shot to death in Cincinnati. So this is not the first time we've seen such a tragic death. We're hoping it doesn't happen again.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Betsy. I've been speaking with Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Elizabeth Kim. Thank you so much for your time and for your reporting.
Thanks, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. And if you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.